Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mastering Risk Management. I'm Anthony Wilson, and great to have your company again. Today's guest is another wonderful US-based citizen and is going to share her experience with us today, and that is Brittany Allen. And Brittany is a trust and safety architect at SIFT. So there's our first question, what a trust and safety architect is. She has more than 13 years of experience combating e-commerce marketplace fraud at companies such as Etsy, Airbnb, First Dibs, and Letgo. Her current role focuses on trust and safety education, developing industry best practices and strategies, representing the merchant's voice at SIFT, and being a trusted industry source for publications including Fortune, Fast Company, Bloomberg, The Hill, Forbes, and more. So, Brittany Allen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you for making the time. So, we might come back to the architect thing, but let's just first start with how you got into your role. So I'll typically ask my guests, you know, you were sitting in school or university or whatever, and some thought struck you about what your career might be. What was the journey? How did you get to where you are now?
So I wish I had a story like that made it seem like I had planned all of this out from the get-go. But that is not the way that it worked when you got into trust and safety around the time that I did, which would have been in 2010. So I actually went to university to become a history teacher. I double majored in history and in German. And no, if you can, I don't know if you can speak German, but we cannot switch to German for the rest of this podcast. A little bit rusty there. But I actually spent time teaching high school history and civics and economics, for example. And I then got caught up in the economic crash in about 2008 and 9, the Great Recession. And that meant that in the school district I taught in, where the rule was last in, first out, that I was out of a job and also competing against people with way more experience than me to try to get a different job within teaching. So long story short, I had a cousin who graduated that year with an equally sort of difficult to find work degree in art. And we both moved to New York City and just tried to see what we could do to make a go of it. And I ended up getting a position at Etsy where they were initially interested in having me fill a customer service role. But during the course of the interview, when they asked one of those standard questions of talk about a difficult scenario you've worked through, I brought up some experience that I had volunteering for a website called couchsurfing.org, which was a great way to meet people from around the world and travel for free by staying in their homes. And I moderated a group for independent women travelers. And it was a private group where people could discuss very difficult situations. Like, I just got kicked out by my host because he assaulted me and he has my passport. And this is the time before cell phones. So how do I get in touch? What can I do? Please help me through this situation. I don't speak the local language. And by telling those stories, they paused and said, you know what? We actually might have a different role for you. And I got to join their abuse team, which meant my first ever business card said Brittany Allen, abuse specialist. And I'm very happy to say that they switched over to the term trust and safety, which is now so much more synonymous with fraud prevention. And that is that abbreviated sort of story of how I went from teaching to dealing with chargebacks and identity theft. But so many other people like me in the trust and safety space have just as layered of a story, because back then you didn't go to school to learn how to prevent fraud.
Yeah.
You just didn't.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic and a fascinating story, Brittany. And probably the exception rather than the rule would be those people that sit in university and say, this is what I'm going to do, and then end up doing it. We all seem to sort of navigate our way through a path that we probably didn't plan and end up somewhere quite fabulous anyway. So well done. So talk to us about the role at SIFT. So trust and safety architect, what does that mean? What are the responsibilities of the role?
So I joke and say it means that I get a lot of misdirected LinkedIn requests or offers for jobs for people who are looking for an actual architect who could help design a building. But what I'm referring to with the architect within that trust and safety architect title is more of how to build and organize and guide your fraud prevention approach. So we're a very small team here at SIFT, and we're all merchants. We've spent time working for companies. You named off the ones that I've worked for, but we also have people on our team who've worked for Stripe, Square, Google, Meta. So we bring all of that experience of having been on the front lines and then do our best to share that information. So I will, for example, present at conferences. The ones that I have coming up in the next few months, I'm actually teaching a Fraud 201 course. So that's a 3-hour intensive course for people with 2 or more years in trust and safety experience. I'm speaking on marketplace fraud. I'm talking about KYC vulnerabilities, specifically with fintech and iGaming. So I get to sort of cover all of those things that for me are extremely interesting. And I get to do a lot of research and learn about fraud. But then I also get to help the customers who use SIFT and who aren't sure how to proceed with fraud prevention and help them identify fraud they may have never seen before. And then lastly, a big part of my role is monitoring the deep and dark web, or we refer to by the shorthand DDW, and finding those fraud patterns there, whether they're related to global events, like a lot of the fraud that changed during the pandemic, or technology, like, for example, just last week when WormGPT closed, and updating on, you know, what fraudsters' tools are now available. So it really covers a lot, and it means I'm pretty tired usually.
So there's a lot to unpack there. And before we maybe do, just explain for the listeners who SIFT is and what they do.
So SIFT is a fraud prevention solution. We're a leader in digital trust and safety. So think about anything that could be fraud related that is online. So that could be payment fraud with the use of a stolen credit card to purchase something, or it could be account takeover when people say, my account was hacked. That's what they're referring to. And it could also be any kind of content scam or spams, like misinformation online, those kind of posts. And all of that coming together is the opportunity that we have to be able to help companies protect themselves and their community.
Right. Excellent. So an online retailer, somebody wants to set up a marketplace, those sort of things, you're going to help them with advice about the security aspects, making sure that payments go through safely, all of those sort of things.
Exactly. So not only making sure that they prevent fraud to prevent loss, but they stay in compliance with regulation. There's a lot to consider, especially, again, if we're talking to somebody who doesn't have that experience in fraud prevention and isn't sure where to start.
Yeah, lovely. No, that's great. That sounds like fascinating work. What stage typically will you engage a client? I wonder whether, and you know, we specialize in risk at ABM Risk Partnership. So often a client's sort of gone on a journey, struggled and stumbled a little, and you know, not feeling like they're getting the value from the effort they're putting in. And we'll come in and help them sort of right the ship and get it back in the right direction. At what stage typically would a client be reaching out to SIFT? Are they already established and getting a bit frustrated that things are happening? Or are they saying, hey, listen, we're going to build this from a blank sheet of paper and we want to do it right from the start? What does a typical client look like, if there is such a thing?
So I mostly work with companies where they are looking to make a change. They either see a massive fraud attack they had that their current solution didn't catch, or they know that they're, let's say, expanding into a new geography or to a new vertical, and there's challenges there they won't be able to get ahead of. But we've also done it where we have worked with somebody from scratch, a company that knew, you know, a year out they were going to completely shift gears and change their entire business model, and now we're going to be accepting payments that they needed to have a fraud prevention solution in front of. So we've seen it happen multiple ways. The way we don't want it happening, of course, would be the responding to a massive fraud attack where they weren't prepared. It's no fun to walk into those situations where people are already on edge and companies are already potentially, you know, in the media or in the public eye because of a data breach.
Yeah, and unfortunately it's happening with monotonous regularity at the moment. So I'd imagine, and you know, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'd imagine it's not a hard sell to convince a CEO of an organization that this is a very worthwhile investment. Is that true, or do you have some challenging engagements?
You know, from my experience as a fraud manager, it can be a tough sell. You would think that there would be a natural desire to just eliminate fraud, prevent fraud. But that requires an acknowledgement that fraud is a problem. And I have been in organizations before where they just don't either have the education or don't have the willingness to believe that there are people out there, there are criminals out there that are going to target our platform. I've been told point blank, fraud takes care of itself. Fraud's not a big deal. While I have a team that is, you know, barely holding back sort of the flood of attempts due to the nature of what we sell. And so that can be in and of itself a huge challenge. And also there's a hesitation sometimes to invest more in trust and safety because that unit of the business can be seen as the revenue killers. I hate to say that, but we're the ones that cancel orders. We're the ones that shut down accounts. And so it requires, in some cases, a fraud manager to be able to come in and change those perspectives within leadership. And then you may have more success getting that investment. So it's not always easy, unfortunately.
Yeah. And there is, there can be a prevailing element, I guess, of, oh, well, fraud is just a cost of doing business. And, you know, at a certain level, we just have to put up with it.
Right. Especially if it is perceived as harming the primary goal of a company. Like, let's say we're a social media platform and our big push this year is to increase views and monthly active users. If we're not looking at the quality of those users and the quality of those views, yeah, theoretically, views from bots that are malicious count, or account registrations that are happening en masse for fraudulent purposes, those count as well. And so it can actually affect those numbers. At one company I worked at previously, the sort of numbers similar to that actually were going to affect the entire company's yearly bonus. So if you can imagine speaking up and saying, no, actually, we have not met our goal yet. We need to reduce this because we had a lot of fraud we didn't catch, and that is not legitimate. And then people looking at you because you just cost them a couple $1,000 at the end of the year at Christmas time. Yeah. Again, you're not the most popular person in the room, although it is the right thing to do and to point out because it's that number is not a reflection of a healthy business.
And we've seen some very public cases of numbers of users versus actual users, and maybe the two aren't actually the same. So we should leave that where it is as well. So, Brittany, I'm curious, is there an industry or is there a type of online that is more susceptible than others or more attractive to fraudsters than others? Do you find that?
So fraudsters will have their specialization with what they're good at. Some are good at social engineering and thrive on interactions with people because they're able to manipulate them. Think dating scams or sort of anything else, influencers that are scam influencers. But then others are much more specialized in sort of the tech behind it. They may end up building tools to sell within the larger fraud economy, but they do all support each other. I think in the end, when it comes to sort of consumers, the everyday people using the internet, what is something that we'll run into the most, that's most targeted by fraudsters, would be anything that is instant or has a quick delivery or where you're told to make a very quick decision. So getting a phishing link in an email that looks convincing and you choose to click it, you know, from that moment that you've clicked that link, there's a potential that you've just added malware to your device. And now you're part of a larger bot network that can actually be resold. And all of your saved credentials within your browser are now available somewhere for a price. And then someone can log into those accounts. Like that ripple effect can happen just from that one moment of a click. And so fraudsters know the more urgency that they can communicate and the quicker they can get somebody to make a decision, the more successful they'll be. And that lends itself well to social media. That lends itself well to anything digital, online, and quick for delivery.
Yeah. Brittany, it might be a bit of a naive question, but is some of this driven by the cryptocurrencies, those sort of things? Is there a lot of that associated with these fraud attempts?
So we'll see fraudsters almost across the board only wanting to accept a digital currency as payment.
Yep.
They'll say Bitcoin. They'll say Ethereum. If you asked me this question years ago, maybe during 2020, I would tell you they accept any coins because we would see them posting that when we do our deep and dark web monitoring. But since then, due to the crash of a lot of those altcoins, we've seen them sort of close their sites down to just Bitcoin, Ethereum, some of the bigger players. But they will accept those as payment methods because they already know about some of the disadvantages of the more traditional payment types. An example to call out would be credit cards and the ability to file chargeback disputes. So fraudsters already know about that. And some fraudsters who will use a stolen credit card, they don't care about that process, but others that want to look more convincing to a merchant will actually either open a credit card under their own identity or under a synthetic identity, and then use that card to make a purchase, and they can file a chargeback dispute to get their money back. We're seeing that shift occur as the card networks are cracking down more on fraud reason code disputes to then these non-fraud reason code disputes. I was actually speaking to a cryptocurrency company a few months back, and they spoke on their chargebacks shifting to people claiming that they had bought a physical good and that physical good had not been delivered when really they had purchased Bitcoin via this platform. And so without getting into too much detail on chargebacks, because that is not a very, well, I mean, it can be interesting to some, but it could be a pretty convoluted process. When you respond to disputes based on the reason code, that dictates what evidence you need to submit. And for a physical good non-delivery, that credit card company is looking for a signed proof of delivery. That's what they want. And instead, this cryptocurrency company was having to say, no, actually, we're a crypto exchange and wallet. We do not sell physical goods. Therefore, we don't have a POD. And they had to spend so much effort arguing and explaining who they are. They lost a good number of those disputes because to the card network, it didn't make sense when they got the response back, or to the issuing bank. It didn't make sense when they got the response back. It didn't fit what the cardholder claimed. But that cardholder was acting fraudulently. That was a what we would refer to as a fraudster on the other end, not a legitimate customer. So they're aware of that, and they know if they accepted payment for anything that they sell on the deep and dark web in credit cards, they'd probably just get a chargeback. They would probably just lose those funds. So they love that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies don't have that mechanism for dispute or to recall a payment just yet. I know this may be a longer answer than what you expected, but that is really what drives that adoption, is a way to protect themselves almost as safe as if they were able to meet in person and exchange cash.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. Thank you for that. And part of the curiosity for that question is, I actually received a letter yesterday from one of my banks that said, we are now limiting the amount of money we will pay to a cryptocurrency organization. You can have no more than, I can't even remember the amount, was might have been $5,000 or $10,000 in a month, right? So not one transaction in the total month. So we will limit that payment just based on the number of fraud things that are going on and scams that are going on. They'll actually block payments to those organizations. I don't know whether that's happening in the US at the moment. Is that something you're seeing?
There are some scams involved in that, because that kind of cash out fraud where the fraudster is just looking to get funds at the end. They're not buying a physical product or stealing a service of any kind. That can unfortunately target people who are maybe less tech savvy or aren't quite understanding what the norm should be. So we'll see that with elder fraud, for example. And there's a chance that perhaps they've been targeted and told they owe money to the IRS. And they think, oh, I need to pay my taxes. This is very serious. I'm being threatened with the possibility of jail. But you would never pay your taxes in gift cards. You would never pay it in a crypto payment. But they're convinced that that is actually a valid thing to do. And in some cases, that involves the use of an in-person crypto ATM. And so we'll see also instructions that'll send them to those locations where they will insert their currency or insert their credit card, and then immediately send the funds on to the fraudster. So it is a serious challenge, and it can be enabled by cryptocurrency.
No, that's interesting. Are you seeing, and it's usually the case that technology sort of outpaces regulation, and are you seeing any change in attitude of government around this space? Are they helping strengthen defences against this type of fraud? You know, I know here in Australia there's a lot of effort and a lot of discussion going on after a couple of big data type breaches, and I'm just curious, are you feeling that government is taking the matter more seriously, or are they wiping their hands of it and saying, well, sorry, that's up to you. You're the commercial operator. You put in the defences that you need to put in.
I've seen a lot of discussion around it, although I don't think it's gotten to the stage yet where we've seen concrete action. We know what steps will be taken, but you just have to think with all of the different stakeholders involved in the payment and fraud prevention process, who is going to be left holding the bag in scams like the one I just described? So if we go back to that example of somebody who was tricked into sending money to a fraudster, but they did so willingly, are they the ones to take the loss because they made the choice to send the funds? Is the, let's say it happened through a cryptocurrency exchange, is that the party to take the loss because they should have identified that that was an unusual payment from that account holder? Or is it the issuing bank that has the credit card that they used to make that first fiat deposit before they sent the crypto on that should have detected that that was anomalous? None of those parties are, of course, going to want to be the one that is left with responsibility, but someone in the end has to have it. And that's where I think there's going to be a lot more time and discussion along those lines. I was talking with somebody about this earlier, and I mentioned that I've actually seen more and more posts on social media where victims of scams like that are advising other victims to actually not tell the truth to their credit card company when they're trying to get their money back. Don't admit you willingly sent the funds, because then you won't get a refund. Just say your card was stolen and deny that you had any participation in that transaction. So now we're also seeing this behavior develop where legitimate cardholders that might have had this credit card for 20 years are now lying to the credit card company because they were a victim of a scam. Like, what in the end will be the answer? I don't know. Although just me personally, I of course have a lot of sympathy for those who fell victim to the scam, but somebody has to be designated as the responsible loss taker in those scenarios.
Yes, it's challenging. It's challenging for government too to try and put appropriate rules and regulations around this stuff when there's so many parties involved. And as I've said, the technology and the speed of change is so rapid to try and keep up with it. It is challenging for sure.
And the perfect answer would be to reclaim the funds from the fraudster who received them. But then you come into so many more complications, not to, go on a tangent and listing all of them, but just international regulations and barriers to cooperation. What if the victim was in Australia and the perpetrator was in France? Now you've suddenly got to work on both ends of law enforcement there across multiple languages. It becomes a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, thanks for that. I was curious as to your thoughts around that. So I guess you sound very passionate about this stuff, Brittany. So what's the stuff that really brings you joy? What's the most satisfying thing about what you do? And as you're thinking about that, what's the most frustrating thing? What's the hardest in the role that you play?
So personally for me, and this is a little bit selfish, but I'll allow myself to be a little selfish. And that is just that, I went to university to study history. I love researching. I love learning. And I love figuring things out and looking at a pattern of fraud that we don't understand. We're not sure what the end goal of the fraudster is. Why is this account activity happening? And then finding that answer is very satisfying. Or going into the fraud forums that I'll monitor and seeing new phrases, new abbreviations, sort of new chatter, and then cracking that code, understanding what they're talking about, and being able to share that more widely with the customers we work with, that really drives me. But as far as something that's rewarding, that's kind of at that higher level, is I really appreciate the ability to be able to help people. And there's sort of an approach to thinking about, oh, the credit card was stolen, the person gets their money back, it's all fine and dandy, no problems there, there's no real victim, everyone's made whole. But I've actually spoken to people who were victims of identity theft or people who have had their credit card stolen, and it's made a huge impact on their life, where it might, because of the slowness of the refund process, have held a large amount of credit on their credit card that prevented them from taking a trip or making another large purchase, replacing a vehicle. I've spoken to some people who were, they were cardholders of a credit card that you have to be retired in order to hold. And they said that their number was getting stolen about every month, to the point where they felt like they had gone back to work for a part-time job because of the amount of time they had to be on the phone with their bank to clear out all of the fraudulent charges and get a new card issued, to then only fall victim or to have it stolen again the next month. And they were exhausted by that process. So being able to stop fraud really will help people, especially those who are targeted multiple times or in a more vulnerable category. Now, that said, you asked me about what's challenging or what's not as rewarding. I think I might have sort of given a glimpse into it based on all the different directions my answers have already gone. But there really does feel like there's this push to be an expert, to speak to all of trust and safety. You know, it's really grown over the years. Maybe at some point it was mostly policy, and then it became policy and payments fraud. And then it's expanded now to involve way more of just payments by itself and payment orchestration. And then also to touch on cybersecurity. Now that's becoming, you know, more of an overlapping topic. And that can be really stressful for a small team or a team of one at various companies that don't know yet what resources they can turn to. And you're sort of in the hot seat almost to explain the why behind anything bad that's happened at the company you work for. Something bad happened, let's ask trust and safety. And that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we've said, such a rapidly moving sort of area. So, and I guess that leads to the next question as to what's coming down the pipeline. What do you think the next big things in the field are? Be they the next big challenges, as in, you know, the bad guys are getting badder and what's coming, or what are the next sort of glimmering hopes on the horizon for actually, you know, really getting some of this stuff under control? And I hate to use the dreaded initials, but, you know, AI. Is there what's on the horizon, do you think, in the space?
So the challenge of the past couple of years has really been economic uncertainty tied to the global pandemic. You know, not knowing what we're going to do as far as everything shifting online and then stores reopening. So e-commerce drops a bit with its volume. But then we also had the supply chain issues in late 2021 and companies making decisions about layoffs or can we hire to build a team? What will our resources be? So operating in that time of uncertainty has, I think, left quite a few companies hesitant to make changes. But at the same time, fraudsters have been really thriving during this. They took advantage of government loans, like here in the US, the pandemic loans or the small business loans that were given out to companies that were affected by COVID. Fraudsters maliciously filed claims for those loans and got them themselves, making, I can't even quantify the amount. I see it posted by state and it's, you know, in the high millions. It's a huge amount of money that was lost to those scams. And so they've got a lot of those funds to then be able to take their time and test new fraud attacks. So when it comes to what you said about AI, I think that helps point to at least partially a solution. And that's that whether you're struggling about hiring or building a team or what choices to make, that you need to focus on what you can do to better scale your fraud prevention approach, whether that's incorporating machine learning and AI into your system, and then also how to say with data what you're doing and what you're facing. So to actually be able to quantify those losses. And that's just more and more and more important. It sounds now like I need to go back to my original statement about all of the topics blending together and add data science and data analysis into that overall umbrella of what's so important to trust and safety, because it just will continue to be higher volumes of transaction, higher volumes of online activity, and the need for us to respond at scale instead of potentially the manual processes that we're using right now.
Yeah, it's an incredible amount of data that organizations now collect, isn't it? And if they can leverage that data, look for trends and patterns and those sort of things, there's insight. It's not just data, there's insight in there as well. So now that's fantastic, a very good answer. So one more question, and it's the last question I ask most of my guests, and that is, if you were advising a young person considering getting into the field, what sort of advice would you give them about how to succeed and what sort of things they should be looking at to become an expert in the field?
So I'm a little bit lucky when it comes to answering this one, because I actually do volunteer through an org called the TSPA, or the Trust and Safety Professional Association, where I do coffee chats and I'll talk to tons of people who are just starting out or have a little bit of interest, or maybe just have, you know, a few years under their belt within trust and safety and are wondering what else they can do there. So I get to have these conversations in real life, and my suggestions usually fall back to start with networking. Speak to others and find out what their recommended trainings are, what conferences they think might be beneficial for you to attend, what publications you can subscribe to, or what leaders you could follow on platforms like LinkedIn, just to become more aware of what even is covered by trust and safety and what you could potentially do. Then also, I would give the recommendation to always ask for help. Don't forget, we aren't in the old ways of working, you know, solo and being so segmented anymore. When I started in trust and safety in 2010, I identified my first case of money laundering and I had no idea what it was. I didn't know money laundering could happen on an e-commerce marketplace. I didn't know what it would look like, but now there's so many resources where people could help you do that. And we need to continue to break down those barriers, that hesitancy on talking about the bad things that may happen within our organizations so that we can get that help. Like, you'll see some companies say, oh, if we admit that we have fraud, like if we warn a user about clicking links in chat, then they'll just think we're nothing but fraud. But that's not the case. It's better to be proactive. And then lastly, I would say document everything. You don't know when it's going to be useful. I have notebooks going back the 13 plus years of my career where I had made observations about fraud trends or written down some really interesting anecdotes that people had brought up before. And I can't tell you how many times then when I'm asked by a company, you know, what could we do to improve our fraud prevention approach? And a light bulb will go off. And I'll remember something I heard a few years ago that another company very similar to them did. And I can give them that recommendation or guidance. So just make sure you document all of it and keep track of it. You never know what will be useful, especially since you could be working for so many different companies over the course of your career. You could go from social media to crypto to travel to traditional retail.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. So applicable. There's not too many absolutely brand new things in the world. Somewhere somebody's done it or experienced it or been unfortunate to cop the fraud or whatever it was. So, yeah, listen, turn, connect, do those sort of things with people and you'll get a wealth of knowledge. Now, that's great advice. Fantastic. Well, Brittany, that's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for your time. And I'm sure the listeners will absolutely relate to this. It's just such a prevalent thing in our world today, unfortunately. So, thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, listeners, Brittany Allen, Trust and Safety Architect at SIFT. Now, Brittany is on LinkedIn, so I will put her contact details in the show notes, but I'm sure you could look her up and find her on LinkedIn as well. I'm sure she'd be glad to connect with you and share a little bit more. So, hope you enjoyed today's episode. It was a great discussion, and hopefully you've learned something that you can take away to your organisation as well. So, thanks for tuning in again. Look forward to talking to you next time. We'll see you then. Cheers.